to item 9, the status update on the Mojave Salt Nutrient Plan. We have a couple of presentations, so I would like to ask the board if you would join me in the front row so that we can all have the benefit of seeing the spring bonding.
Changes over time. I'll go over that in just a few moments. It is a basin-wide model. It does look at assimilative capacity over these groundwater basins that are in our area. And we are hoping that this tool will be used to leverage, or be leveraged to influence policy decisions based on science in the future. Okay, questions answered by the SNMP. What we try to accomplish. What's the existing groundwater quality look like? Are the concentrations in the basin, are they going up? Are they going down? Are they going sideways? Do we have a problem or do we not have a problem? Can we tell if we have a problem? Is the monitoring network adequate to actually capture these changes over time? And what are the basin plan objectives on a basin or sub-basin wide scale, and are they appropriate? So the salt and nutrient loading impacts. What are the sources of salt and nutrients in our basin? We might see that the basin is changing, but what's causing that? How sensitive are these groundwater basins? And what's making those changes? And what are they more sensitive to? Septic, recycled water, irrigation, return flow, and so forth. So let's talk a little bit about our area. Mojave region is in yellow. It's about 5,000 square miles, and it covers a portion of two regional water quality control boards. We've got Colorado to the south and the Lahontan region to our northwest. The areas that lie within our district boundaries, or our area, really consist of two groundwater basins where people actually use water materially. That's the Mojave Basin in blue and the Morongo Basin in green. We're going to focus on the Mojave Basin in blue for this discussion today because that's what falls in the Mojave area. These groundwater basins are based upon geology, faulting, rock outcrops, watersheds, and whatnot. Also takes into account some of the watershed areas that feed into these groundwater basins. Now, each of these areas are broken up into smaller subregions or management areas. We're, for this purpose, modeling nodes. You can also call it a very sophisticated bucket model, and these are the buckets. We have 20 buckets in this model. And you can see we have the Mojave River with different nodes, and we have the regional aquifer that bracket the Mojave River. And then we have the Morongo area over here. Again, we're focusing more on this for this talk. So these boundaries are based on hydrogeology, natural breaks, also on water quality. There's some geological processes, which I'll talk about in a little bit, that break these areas into management zones. These areas are also aligned with our adjudicated boundaries. We have management areas that we apply our adjudication to, almost like state in our service area, and we want to make sure that those comport with our scientific knowledge and make sure that those fit. Did we just start this process a couple years ago? No, we did not. This process started about 15 years ago. We really got serious about modeling the Mojave region in the late 90s as part of our adjudication process. We really needed to understand how our groundwater basins, multiple, work throughout our region. So we teamed up with the United States Geological Survey for several years to put together a calibrated, pretty sophisticated, but regional scale mod flow model. And that was in 2001. That was mainly based on supply. Since then, we do a lot of work, such as basic conceptual models, we look at cross-sections and geology and production zones and water quality spreads and age meeting and stick diagrams and whatnot. And those are all those works in blue that you see here. But the two very important works in this timeline are the ones in red. Sorry. We took the calibrated USGS model, and during the 2004 Integrated Regional Water Management Plan process, which we really focused on supply back then. We were really supply 10 years ago. Water quality was something we kind of had to do, and now we kind of embrace it. In 2004, we wanted to find out if our suite of projects that we wanted to bring water to the basin were going to meet our sustainable supplies. Are they going to work, or are they not? And so we took the model model and we converted it into a Stella model, which is basically a spreadsheet on steroids to make it simple, so you're not doing model runs all the time. It simplified the model model and got us just what we needed regarding supply. In 2007, something interesting happened. We had a high desert power plant come to our region. They wanted to use injection wells to bank water to make sure that they could keep the plant cool during times of drought where they might be cut off the state water project. The regional board wanted a lot of investigation, and had a lot of questions about what the water quality was going to do if you started to inject water into this basin. They did a bunch of work, and as part of their permit, they gave $500,000 to put towards some type of regional effort to try to understand the water quality changes in the region. That was part of their permitting process, and some of you folks may remember that. We volunteered city events, $500,000 to go to good regional science, we'll take a job. And we worked with the BBWRA at the time, other cities, other stakeholders, and also Hassan Makai was part of that team. He's no longer with us, he's moved on, but he was definitely a part of this process. This turned into a TES transport model. It was kind of blocky. It was a good first effort to try to find out how the sensitivity of our region. More importantly, the real gem out of this process was investing that money to put together a database that was going to pay dividends in the future. You're going to start to see that today. That took every bit of data we could possibly get our hands on and get it into one database that was going to be maintained and built on in the future. So that 2007 effort with the Lahan board to release those funds was the first step in this process that happened about 10 years ago. And then we did a bunch of work since then, geology and whatnot, and here we are today. Okay, what does CELA stand for? Structural Thinking, Experimental Learning, Laboratory Animation. So basically, it took the Modflow model, it took a lot of ins and outs, and again, it looks like a spreadsheet, so it's a very complex, interrelated spreadsheet type model. It's used to track 20 individual subregions over a 70-year predicted period. This has some limitations. It is by comp, so there's instantaneous mixing over large areas. Again, you cannot look for absolute concentrations using CELA in the bucket, but we worked around that, and I'm going to share that in a little bit. And some advantages are that it's fast. It's scalable, and it's actually a really good screening tool that you can use on the fly to find out where your problems are, where you need focus resources, and what areas you don't really have to focus on. Where the areas that are going to be burning, what areas to be left alone. So we're going to talk about big data. Here's all the wells that had TDS that went into the model. Pretty good spread. Cool colors are low TDS, 250 or less. Hot colors are over 1,000 parts per million TDS. And you can see the spread of the basin. You can also see the influence of the Mojave. You can see how things get salt here generally as you move down the basin, moving from cool green to yellow, from blue to green, some yellows, some more reds, and so forth. You can also see the playas, El Mirage Lake, Harper Dry Lake, some of the dry lakes over here, the Baja region, Apple Valley Dry Lake, and so forth. Nitrates, not as much as TDS, pretty darn good. Green colors are white is not in effect. Tin is less than 10 milligrams per liter. Orange is getting close to the MCL, about 22 and above. Red is above the MCL, 45 milligrams per liter. Again, you can kind of see the spread of where you have really good water quality and where you have some areas of concern. See a pretty decent fill here. You do have a little bit of yellow popping up over here. You do have some old ag. And this area, this is around the Hellendale fault area. You see some things going on around Barstow, Harper Lake, and so forth. So it really makes sense. The data makes sense. Now you start doing interpretation. This is for TDS. We try to use the well medians based on the last 5 years of data for the wells that we used in the analysis. We also want to make sure that we don't go blind if we have older data. I talked about we really embrace big data, which means we're going to look at everything. And so in areas where we have a lot of modern, contemporary, good, high-quality data, we'll definitely use that. Our basin isn't like that uniformly. There are areas where we might have a couple samples from 1995, maybe one from 1970. That's still really important. So we also look backwards where we have to, and we include that in the model. We don't go blind or myopic. We try to decluster the data so you don't have bullseyes because, let's say, there's a bunch of samples in Hinkley. That doesn't drive the entire model. We have to honor that. We understand that there's clusters that can because some states are driving your focus. So we decluster those data and we contour and interpolate that into something like this where it becomes very, very useful, where you can zoom in and look at specific areas. And we can walk around for TDS. This is Apple Valley out here. It's a little salty. El Mirage has Darius and Dry Lake out here. Harper Dry Lake. You see the wastewater treatment plant. And this is where this is around the Hellendale area, Hellendale Fault, right through here, where older water is being pushed up and over the Hellendale Fault, driving up mineralized water. Nitrates, same type of analysis. And you can see some areas like Hinkley, Barstow Wastewater Treatment Plant, some agriculture activity out here in El Mirage. And again, so it starts to make sense. And you can see this on a big scale, what your basin is doing and how it's behaving. One of the biggest changes that I'm most proud of in this latest iteration of the model is all that work, all the blue lines and the timeline we've talked about, all the geology. In the first model we put together with Hassan, our buckets were each 1,000 feet deep. That's a 1,000 foot mixing body. So those 20 nodes were 1,000 feet deep. That's a big bucket. And we realized that was wrong. And we knew that was flawed. Since then, we put every EWR well of record into our database. We have tagged it where the drillers hit bedrock. We note that. We're below the stream. We note that. We start to do the analysis, understanding what your basin looks like. And this is depth to bedrock, or depth to basin production zone. There's a difference. Light colors are shallow. Dark colors are deep. Deep basins, deep basin, deep basin are on the periphery, shallow. Shallow. So it makes sense. They're basically shallow around the edges, it's deeper in the middle. Now, what's really important is that all of these nodes got shallower, which means the changes in water quality are going to happen a lot faster over time. Our buckets got a lot smaller, which means our job got a lot more serious. Also, your basin isn't just depth of bedrock. You could have a 10,000 foot deep basin, but if everybody is pulling from 200 to 300 feet below ground surface, that's your production zone, that's where the action is, and that's what you have to protect. Is today and for the foreseeable future. And so that's what this map depicts, and this is how this is one of the big changes in the model. So it honors the geology. And again, if you looked at all the wells on there, every DWR well, so that's big data. So what does that roll up to? You put all these data together, the gray side is the Morongo area, Colorado region, so it's grayed out. And I'm going to walk through, we use our terms that we use for management of adjudication. So LSA is going to be El Mirage. Alto floodplain is going to be the river. Alto is the left regional. Left is left of the river, so Victor Hill. Left, right. Alto is Apple Valley. Transition zones from Adelanto to Hellendale. Centro is basically the Baja, the Barstow area. Baja is the Daggett, Berry Springs area. Naming conventions. This makes a lot of sense to us. I know it might not have made much sense to you. But the important thing here is that now we look at the average water quality concentration across the entire basin, or a bucket, and 500 parts per million, thousands cut off, and 1,500. And you can see where you are today, in general, and where you have a sealed capacity up to 500, and where maybe you absolutely don't have illicit capacity, it's gone. But maybe if you talk, if the limit's up to 1,000, then you have something to talk about. And some basins, like Harper Dry Lake, not surprising, does apply, it's going to have to be mineralized. You're a little bit over 1,000, and maybe this is considered. I don't know, but now you see what the lay of the land looks like.
So, where is the Alto, the floodplain and the regional Alto transition zones? Where are those?
Alto transition zone, regional, is basically east and west of the river between Adelanto and Hellendale. I think where BWR is located. The plant is on the regional, the outfall is in the floodplain. So Logan discharges the floodplain, but some of his plant kind of sits on the regional, that's behind him on his plant or on the regional water, the tighter older sediments.
Thanks.
Nitrates, same thing. It actually looks a little easier. These things are really low across the board. You have scale here, 45, which is the UCL. For nitrate, and you have your different buckets here. Now, this is one of the issues with using a bucket model, is it's a bucket, it's homogenous, it's all mixed up. But we have lots of data, so what do we do with that? Well, this is where you go the extra step, and you zoom in, and each one of those 20 bases almost has a small mini report that talks about the individual nature of that particular bucket. And anyone just just hold the report. There's even the thud factor. You know, just drop it on the ground. Thud. There's a lot of material there, and it's relevant. It's not a data dump. It's actually kind of a synopsis of each one of these buckets. So I'm just going to walk around this particular bucket. This happens to be the central floodplain aquifer, and we're looking at from Helen Hill over here. This is Helen Hill Fault, so where this basin starts. Linwood, Hinkley, Barstow Wastewater Treatment Plant. We're going to look at TDS. This is target read. Actually, I can't read it. I'm just going to tell you what it says. 1950, 2010. So we've got a better than a half a century spread where we have data. In some areas, we have great data that runs the entire span. Other areas are more than the last 20 years. But we can tell our salt loads going sideways. Are they going down? Are they going up? Or are we doing a lot of, or was there a lot of activity in certain basins that ours isn't here today? Things have changed. So this also tells the difference between each of these buckets. Now, this double well is going to tell you this is all one concentration, but in general, it's correct when you zoom out, but when you zoom in, you can see, based on our contouring interpolation of the data that we have, there are areas that show differences in water quality in this basin. All this red, high TDS water, that's mineralized water that's coming up from the Helen Hill Fault. River's flowing, hits the fault, gets pushed up, goes over, drops into the basin. So that's what you have here. Move up through here at Hinkley. It's got a lot of agricultural activity and whatnot, and we're pretty familiar with that. So you see a red spot. Here we have Barstow, and the wastewater treatment plant is located in this area. Most of you are familiar with the activities that are going along there. So this all makes sense. So there are areas that have anthropogenic issues going on. There are areas that have big geologic issues going on and have been going on for a very, very, very long time. And then you have other parts of the basin that tend to be a little fresher. How do you manage that? That's a question for staff to make recommendations and the board to decide, but at least you have data to work with. So what went into the Stella model? Well, each of those nodes had all of these inputs and outputs that went into it. We're going to use this central floodplain node, this bucket right here, and we had inflow from the regional aquifers, these older sediments that bracket the Mojave River. Inflow from the Alta Transition Zone. This is the water that kind of gets the older water that gets pushed up over the Helen Hill Fault and drops into Centro. State Water Project imports, natural stream recharge, wastewater treatment, effluent, septic tanks, agriculture, return flow, municipal return flow. Those are the ends going out as groundwater pumping and out of the basin to the next basin is upflow to Baja, so here, into the river floodplain aquifer, and outflow into the central regional aquifer if heads push water out of this bucket into the adjacent regional aquifer. So this process is based on a calibrated modular model. It's relying upon all the buckets that are upgraded, downgraded, Darcy type issues, and this is happening over and over again over a 7-year period. So now that model, we built it. We wanted to look at a couple of different scenarios. And we really focused on, all this talks about the inputs and outputs, but the real focus here is we looked at 2012 conditions and just froze it. We closed off the Cajon Pass, and won't come in anymore, and you just keep doing what you're doing. The next is we looked at our growth projections, like our urban water management plans and our other planning documents that are based on SCAG and so forth, and which are pretty good. And we looked at forward no recycled water projects. Our third scenario was growth with recycled projects that people could actually get data for. It wasn't a wish project, it was a real project, and people had numbers that they could put the model. That was one of the rules. I think it's wishes, yeah, it's numbers. So, what made it into the model? We had sub regionals from Apple Valley and Hesperia that Logan's involved in. We have some, the city of Victorville was doing some changes or wanted to do some changes to their excess recycled water material at UWRA Pond 14. Logan can talk about that if you have any questions. We have Hellendale Recycled Water Reclamation Plant. It was something that was on the books that looked like it was very serious for the numbers to put into the model, so we wanted to honor that. And this is a regional water treatment plant out in the Warren Valley or Yucca Valley, Colorado region, so it doesn't really apply here. So we run this model, we run it out 70 years. To really go through this, we have to show you 20 different stories, because every one of those buckets has an individual story. We're not going to do that. I'm going to focus on something that's actually interesting that came out of the model. We saw some sensitivity, and we're going to focus in on the Alto Right Regional, or the Apple Valley Regional Aquifers. Think Hawk River, Apple Valley. It's an area, it's a water community. It's been dominated by septic tanks for a number of years. And there's been a concern that there's going to be septic loading with this groundwater basin over time. And so this is something we definitely take serious. It's something that was definitely in the model, and we actually saw an effect enough worthy to share. So that's why I made it into this presentation. So we're going to look at TDS and nitrates. We're going to look at, this is the upper limit of TDS 1000. So this is the TDS recommendation of 500. This is a 70-year run here, and concentration here on the left. So you already started with 500. The base water quality is already over about full under 600, so you're already above 500. So there's no similar capacity to 500. That's gone. That's gone by. That's already gone. Now we're talking a race to 1,000. Growth, no more people. Anthropogenic influence stays the same. This keeps on moving up. There basically gets a little salty over time. Again, I want to remind you, this is a 70-year spread. Now we look at the yellow line, which is growth with no recycled water. And we start moving up to getting close to 1,000 parts per million at the end of 70 years. And then we look at recycled water. And it actually had a maternal effect of us, a negative 74 milligrams per liter over this period. Part of this reason is that the discharge from the regional treatment plant is capped at 350 parts per million. That's not right with the effluent. So they have to discharge water no more than that quality, and that's different than the septic return flow under the growth with no recycled water. So these types of projects are already having an effect that you don't realize until maybe several decades out, but it is material. And it also shows that if additional sewering or different ways we use water or manage this particular basin, we might actually be able to bring that purple line down. We might have less growth, that'll help. We might expand recycling water facilities, that could help. The other things we can do over the next 70 years, but we know this is a sensitive basin, one of the more sensitive basins is septic, and we know that we can change it. For nitrates, same type of story. And we see that over the course of time, with growth, we do see a small influence of nitrate. If that's something that we need to talk about and begin in the future decades moving up to increase or reduce the amount of nitrates going in or doing other processes, that's something that we can at least look at and anticipate and control in the future. But again, nothing much happens for a very long time. But according to modeling, it does happen. I'm sure we'll rerun the model sometimes for the next 7 years. So I'm hoping. So that's an example of each of those buckets. An example of a state water project that was something that was near and dear to Harbar, we wanted to make sure that the model captured. State water project quality average for the last 10 years has been about 215 milligrams per liter. It goes up, it goes down as water moves through the delta. We have a policy internally that we try to maximize our imports of water quality to it. There's a lot of water in the delta. And we're kind of restricted from imports, so there's not a lot of water in the delta because there's not a lot of water in the delta to get. So, if I give you an example, like last year when the delta was 5%, or that's all we could get out of the state water project, that's probably not the best water quality because not a lot of snowpack is moving through and keeping that clean. Did we import a lot of water during that time? No. So, it's kind of a self-regulating system. When you can import a lot of water, that's the best water to get because it's raining and snowing a lot. So, that, but on the long-term average, it's 250. And with managing imports when water quality is better and available, probably drives that number down. Simple average is 250. Nitrates hanging at about 2.5, so very low nitrate water. Sometimes we import water into groundwater basins that have lower TDS. The native TDS is lower than, say, project water. And some basins we have, the basins are higher in TDS than, say, project water. So one could be a benefit and one could be a detriment. It kind of depends on your perspective and how far looking you are. This is an example of the OSA bucket, El Mirage and Feeling. Native water quality, relatively high, around 800 parts per million. You have good water depth. Here's your scale here, the concentration CDS meters. You also have inflows and outflows. Remember that body diagram, all ins and outs. You have really beautiful mountain front recharge coming into this basin, about 200 milligrams per liter or less. You have subsurface inflow from the regional aquifers of LA County and the other areas that flow into the basin. You also have things like agricultural return flow, municipal return flow, septic tank return, has much higher TES. Those are all going into this groundwater basin continually over time, especially since people live there and they're going to live there. These inputs are going to flow in continually, which is going to drive the concentration of the groundwater basin up in TDS. So it increases slowly, but the anthropogenic effects can be seen. When you model this and add 250 part per million state project water into this bucket, it clearly pollutes it and it drives that TDS level down. So that's a pretty clear, kind of obvious example of, wow, can we put really low TDS water in a high TDS bucket and it makes the bucket lower TDS? Sure, that makes sense. What about groundwater basins that have a lower TDS than state water project? Here's an example of the Alto Floodplain Aquifer. That's the upper Mojave River from the Mojave River Dam, the Forsyth Dam, all the way out towards northern Victorville, southern Alabama, Long River. The native water quality in the river there is about 200 parts per million. There's a lot of snow melt, rainfall, and whatnot. Beautiful. But you also have, this is your stream recharge right down here. So it's actually very, very low. It's coming in almost to like 100 parts per million, so it's very clean water. You also have wastewater imports. You have Crestline CSD that's discharging out in Summit Valley. You have Arrowhead that's discharging right out on the floodplain aquifer, right by the Hesperia Lakes, the park they have there. You also have septic return flow coming in. You have subsurface inflow that's old water, mineralized water from the regional aquifer that's coming in. You've got agricultural return flow, and you've got municipal return flow and irrigation return flow coming in as well. So you've got beautiful water coming in. You've got relatively good water, native, but people still live there. The basin still turns over. You still see the anthropogenic effects. These don't stop. And eventually, you salt up your basin. That's why we're doing this model. We know that's going to happen. We're trying to figure out how to control it and how long it's going to take. So what happens is when you don't add state project water, eventually you get past that 250 average line, and you keep increasing. No more imports. Once you get to this point, you start adding 250 part per million water in addition to all these other lower quality sources. Again, it acts as a buffer, it dilutes, and so if your time span is long enough, state water project water actually helps the effects, buffer the effects of anthropogenic sources in all the basins we looked at. This condition applies. This really bookends both categories. Yeah. Groundwater basin with high TDS water already, so it's an immediate benefit, and we've got our most pristine basin, which we still have a benefit over time. So, all of this rolls up in a beautiful synopsis of each of the 20 basins, which I encourage you to look at, but it kind of comes down to this theme. And this is scenario one, this is growth, no growth, just keep doing what we're doing and run it out 7 years. Here are our groundwater basins. This is Morongo, the Colorado region, so you can disregard this. You have your average TDS in your groundwater basin. You have your average nitrate. And you have your basin management objectives, 500, 1,000, 1,500. So this is simply, on this cell here, for the Baja Newberry Springs area, 617 TDS, negative 117 silica capacity. If you assume 1,000 silica capacity, you get 338 milligrams per liter to work with. If you're going to move it up to 1,500 for this basin, you have 883 milligrams per liter to work with. That's all this is. And that's done for each of the basins. It gives you kind of a simple tool to look at. Scenario 3 is the same table. This is just a model run for recycled water projects. I think what's important here is that if you look at the orange cells, not a whole lot changes over the next 70 years. The numbers change slightly, but nothing is breaking over into the next tier of silica capacity. Nothing's busting the silica capacity. So these changes are slow, but they do happen, you know, with glacial speed and also glacial inertia that we need to recognize. So to wrap this up, looks like recycled water projects don't result in a significant facility capacity use in the buckets that we looked at. We are not recommending any changes to the basin plan objectives. We are hoping that this tool will be the technical foundation for our policy decisions for the region where we collaborate later in the future. And this is something that Mike wanted asked about stormwater. What about stormwater? We talked a lot about recycled water projects. So we, as part of our adjudication, stormwater surface water, and our adjudication states that we cannot hold back stormwater because what it does is it affects every bucket down the line. So it's almost like a diversion. Stormwater has to flow naturally. You can shave off peaks for health and safety. You can capture it in like an open culvert, let it flow out without having a big gush of water. You can put it behind a dam that's open and shave off the peaks and let it flow, but you cannot hold it back to let it percolate into any individual groundwater basin. That is one of the underpinnings of our adjudication. So at this point, we didn't have any projects that were going to hold back storm flow. Now, there were discussions of dry wells, there were discussions of low-impact communities, and those types of things are really kind of coming into vogue as things we need to really look at. We didn't have, numbers to put in the model at this point, but we have a tool that we can if we have real numbers to use. Or if we need to focus in on a particular sub-basin, the tool and the data and the model still exist, and if something needs to be modeled, we can. We started this process 2+ years ago. Those did not exist when we asked. We have nothing to put into the model. So I don't think it's a deficit. I just think it shows that projects and ideas and concepts and management actions mature over time. We have a model. You look at the timeline. It's not stagnant. We can update it as appropriate. And basically, we're waiting to hear when it's appropriate. I want to say that this really was a collaborative effort. We had Anna working with each of the regional boards very closely to get a lot of the waste discharge data into this system. A lot of it isn't digital yet, so we've been working hard to get that digital. That's something to work for in the future. That's great. We've got a pretty robust monitoring program that we do not intend to walk away from. When we gave birth to this thing collectively back in 2007 during the SALT model we put together, it was a really important piece of work. We don't intend to walk away from it anytime soon, if ever. All these data are publicly accessible. They really consist of Title 22 data, Gamma, USGS, DWR, Mojave, and GeoTracker. Yeah, so that really is a monitoring program. It's everything. It's big data. Everything. And we're committed to working with you. Have been in the past, we're committed to working with you in the future. Our draft can be found apparently in a CD in your packet, but it also can be found on our website. There's the link. Or just go to our available search window for the SALT nutrients. It's all there for you. And I really want to thank you for the release of SET funds that helped fund this project and the preset funds that helped get us this thing going back in the mid-2000s with the SALT model together in the first place. I really like the fact that this money was kept regionally, but I'm editorializing. And I really like the fact that back in the mid-2000s, we were investing in something that was kind of scary. What are we going to get? We're not sure. We got a database and a so-so model, but there was faith that we're going to continue to work collaboratively together, use everything to get our hands on, and do better in the future. That's a big Hail Mary catch pass for faith. But here we are, and I think we've got a good product, and I think it'll improve in the future if we just keep our eyes involved and work together. So that's it. Do you have any questions?
I think if it pleases the board, if we could hear maybe the next presentation, and then we can go back up there and ask those questions.
That's gone on to this point. and it will continue. So, does this salt nutrient management plan comply with the state board's recent water policy? It does. As you saw, with the basin-wide groundwater monitoring system, it extensively complies with that. We've got good data, and we'll continue to collect data. Those data will help us to understand the salts and nutrients in the sub-basin. That's the intent of the policy, is that we can manage, we can't manage what we don't know. We've got the data to do that, and we'll be able to address any changes in the future, and if the water quality changes do occur. A little bit more proactively, do we know about the sewer capacity, as you saw from the slides? We've done that with all of the sub-basins, so we've got a good idea of where we're bumping up against the similar capacity, or anthropogenically, or a combination of naturally and anthropogenic sources. We may be above 500. We're looking at that next level. We've got an idea of where those basins are, and it's also giving us, I'll show you later on, the sensitivity to which sub-basins we need collectively to put our resources towards. And then Lance mentioned that there's no proposed change in water quality. So one of the ideas for the state water boards and recent water policy was some projects may require us to revisit our water quality objectives, therefore change our basin plans, and then you all would adopt those changes. Well, we're not proposing any of those here today. We've got a good idea of, for all those projects that are currently ongoing, we have an idea of what their input effect is to water quality and what it will be over that 7-year period. There are no new projects being proposed right now. So that's the one bullet I want to just point out is that we're not going to need to hit that particular item at this point. But maybe it will occur sometime in the future with the city. So, looking at this, what are we going to do with this plan? You see here on the left-hand side is Mojave Water Agency's service area. It's also the study area. We have a lot of data in that study area. So, what we're going to know, time now, is which basins are sensitive. And this is Lance's slide we saw earlier, but I don't have on here is the concentration. This is all TDS. Red's bad, green's good, essentially. But what we know is today which sub-basins are sensitive, which basins that we may want to put some more resources towards. But also, with those data in this network, we'll be able to see what are the changes in water quality over time with respect to climate change, population growth, overdraft, those kinds of things, because this is not a static system. None of these sub-basins are static. There will be some changes over time. But we've got the tool that's actually looking at it. And then if we do have any projects that come down the line in the future, recycled water projects or others that have a change in water quality over time, we've now got a model that we can put that information into and get some kind of analysis, some predictive analysis, to know, well, what's going to be the change over time? I think that is hugely important. Not only is it important, it's also a foundation for any future discharge or water land use in the sub-basins over time. We strongly encourage those project proponents to become part of the Mojave Water Agency's urban planning, because through that network, they'll understand just how their project is going to have an influence or impact within this whole system. It's all about water quality or water management. And that's essentially that's the organization that's doing the bulk of the water management within the sub-basins. Other members of EBWRA, we've got members from Lake Arrowhead that are coming down. So it's expanded over time. It's become a pretty robust organization. On the right-hand side, also want to point out going into the future. So we're looking at TDS. We've got similar maps for nitrates, nitrates salts. So we have an idea of which sub-basins are, there's some red areas. Are those anthropogenic? No. In this case, down the Harpo Valley, that's naturally occurring. But we do know in some areas, like in here, that Lance pointed that particular piece out, just downstream of Hellendale, yeah, there are some naturally occurring increases in results because of the geology and the hydrogen geology. There are also some anthropogenic sources as well. There are a couple of downgrading of that fault. So that's going to tell us, with more and more staff, where we're going to put our resources. How are we going to start formulating plans and ideas to help reduce that salt nutrient loading in those parts of the basins that are in the red that need that type of attention for anthropogenic reasons? That leads me to the next point. And we don't know that in the permitting process for point sources, like wastewater treatment plants and other discharges, we're trying to get those types of discharges and water quality changes to protect our water quality objectives and our basin plan, or I should say our beneficial uses. So we all know that there are limitations in terms of resources. And there is a new concept that's actually not new, water quality trading, where, as you can see, the definition there of water quality trading, but basically what we're saying is that one discharger compensates another to employ a waste load reduction for a certain amount of actually less costly waste load reduction to achieve the same results, or even better. So an example might be a wastewater treatment plant applying resources to a non-point source like an agricultural operation, employing best management practices, and achieving the same waste load reductions. In those cases, non-point source load reductions over time. So it's a way to move some resources within a sub-basin to an area to achieve much, much more effective water quality improvement. What you'll see, though, and like I said, it's not new. Federal EPA put out guidance back in 2003, and then subsequently they created this water quality trading assessment handbook. It's a good guidance that's out there. And you'll see nationwide this is happening in a lot of states where they've got legislation and environmental guidance out to work through programs for trading. One of the things that you'll note with water quality trading is primarily directed towards salts and nutrients, and it's right now it's surface water focused. So, particularly areas where there are TMDLs, where there are impaired surface waters, and TMDLs have been established, that framework is really good to help out with the water quality trading type of scenario or a solution. And like I said, it's nationwide. There's a number of states that are doing it. In fact, one I would call out would be Maryland. You see a number of actually Maryland has put out a nutrient trading policy that's actually worked with a number of states trying to reduce nitrogen or nutrient loads just today by 60% over time. Doing a really good job. In fact, other states are working through that as well. So it's a multi-state initiative. Legislation already been passed, the guidelines have already been put out, and so there's a water quality trading going on. As I said, it's nationwide. It's also happening in California, although it's not state board, and California doesn't have an official program. It's happening in local areas within watersheds. In fact, we have one in Tahoe, associated with Tahoe TMDL. So there is one in the region that's currently ongoing. And like I said, it is a surface water type of solution. We came together in 2013 and formed what we call the Fellowship of Mojave, which was essentially a board of board staff and stakeholders, including Mojave Water Agency, EPWRA, and recently the Mojave Resource Conservation District, as well as PG&E, and talked about it. So, you know, the PG&E is doing a similar thing with its farm trading or swapping out in Hinkley. But in this context, we wanted to bring them into the solution because we know that we do, from looking at data, we do have some sub-basins that we need to apply some attention to. Traditional permitting methods have not been as effective as we'd want. We want to see a little bit more of a reduction in nutrients and salts. So came together and thought, well, let's evaluate and investigate how well water quality training work in a groundwater type of scenario. So that's why I'm bringing this up to you today, is that we are looking at something that's new. Concept has been proven, it's seen nationwide, but it hasn't been applied in a groundwater situation. But we think that there is some likelihood that this could be successful applying it in Mojave. So to that end, we've met on a regular basis, and some of the stakeholders of the UWRA and Mojave Water Agency have put together a proposal to the Bureau of Reclamation for a basin study, which was accepted just last month. And we'll probably, once it's accepted, assuming it will be accepted, I think it's got some good positive feedback so far from the feds, that you're talking about a 1 to 2 year program where they will take the data that we've got, look at the hydrogeology as well as the sources and or I should say, as well as the water demands within the basin, not just water quality, but also water demands. And then they're going to also evaluate whether or not water quality training is a concept that can be applicable. But some of the things that you need to look at, are we talking about the same kinds of pollutants? You know, we're going to be able to trade apples and apples, not apples and oranges. So are we talking about phosphorus? Are we talking about nitrates? Are we talking about TDS? Also, is there a market? Is there timing? In other words, could this work where you could apply or purchase credits in one part of the basin, but you get that result that immediately once you apply the credits, not 10 years down the road? You know, those are some things that are going to have to evaluate. Don't have any answers right now. We just started this process. I think that the most important part is that we're thinking about a different approach to try to resolve some of our salt and nutrient loading in the Mojave Basin where we can. And I think this is an opportunity. This is we're really looking forward to any comments from the board or the public as their thoughts on this. But I think that this is another way that we might be able to get that salt nutrient reduction over time in this type of a process. So that being said, I'm going to go to the questions from my agenda.
Regional boards are being the same, but I don't expect that it's going to change.
And but we should be able to, in fact, we should be able to accept it finalized by September. That's the goal. In terms of accepting water quality trading in our sub-basin or our basin, I will let you know that a member of the inter-aeration working group that's revising State Board Resolution 6816. One of the things that we're doing to revise that policy is looking at making a groundwater removal amounts. In fact, we're calling it the groundwater policy. And some of the options that we're looking at, we're actually putting in language, draft language now, that was actually call out water quality trading as an option. So we're trying to get this statewide influence.
I do.
Any questions for Matt? I think other people should ask questions before I do because I have so many different things I ask. Mr. Jardine, do you have any questions for Matt?
Well, it is quite an education, just presentation. We talked about water quality and trees and all that. I'm directing you to be able to solve that problem. And if not, I'm kind of driving to you and my concerns without. That's just an observation, no questions.
Mr. Humphrey, any questions?
I did. Had a couple with respect to water quality trading. And I think you probably answered one of them, which was, does it appear as though the state is going to move in the direction of establishing some kind of policies with respect to that? It sounds like the answer to that is yes. My other question was, it's not I hope it doesn't sound critical because it's not meant to be. But I'm just wondering if water quality trading, I would not want it to become just a punt down the road where over time the people who are using this as a tool to not have to spend large amounts of money to deal with reduction issues have to spend larger amounts of money due to inflation and increasing costs to deal with those very same questions in the future because we have used up whatever cushion a water quality trading a viable idea right now. Is it realistic to say that this is more than that, if it actually, in conjunction with some of the other things that are in the plan that we'll discuss today, actually mean that that would not happen?
It's so preliminary right now, Mr. Humphrey, that certainly that concern is, I'm sure, has been voiced by a number of agencies, states that have done this over time. I can't say whether or not that's going to be a problem or not. We don't even know if water quality trading will work. We really have to go out there and look at it. So that's, people say that's kind of the answer. It's so preliminary right now.
Yeah,
your concern is due to the ability.
I was just going to add to that, other questions. Salt nutrient management is the baseline. A study that we're hoping to get from the Minister of Recreation draws down further to the baseline. Rules of the game of trading, we have to be very careful about that. You're correct. We're not even near that yet. We're still building the baseline and the foundation. But I know other states, particularly in the climate change cabinet, which is a similar model, all those issues that you raise and even more with the communities, people watch very carefully. So to get to the stage of designing the rules of the game, we have to be very, very careful about it.
Mr. Samuel?
Mike, I thought I heard you mention that there was already water quality training going on under the Tahoe TMD. Could you give us a little bit of information about that?
Well, that program, I think Lori will probably talk more precisely on that, so I want to do that.
My name is Lori Kessler. For the record, this is the executive officer. Mike was correct in stating that the water quality training policy, the concept was evaluated at Lake Tahoe. And we received an EPA grant to look into doing water quality training at Lake Tahoe. And on the map, it looked like there was Lake Tahoe was sort of highlighted. That was actually the Truckee River. My understanding is there is a water quality training policy in, on the Nevada side, you know, for the city of Sparks and Reno and Washoe County. At Lake Tahoe, we did not develop. So a similar grant to what we have for the Mojave is evaluating, can it work here? We decided that it could not. And that was primarily because of some of the things Mike talked about market, people looking for credits, essentially. And in Tahoe, everyone needed to reduce pollutant loads, and everyone had a large amount of reduction. So what we did through the evaluation of water quality training policy is we used pieces of programs that were related to water quality training to develop our Lake Tahoe pollutant load reduction crediting programs. So the Lake Tahoe crediting program sometimes gets confused with water quality training. But essentially, we said all these entities, there's not a lot of growth that's going to happen in Tahoe. There is no assimilative capacity. There is no ability to give people nitrate or sediment or phosphorus credits, per se, you know, that they were going to add and then therefore had to subtract. It was like everyone needed to subtract. And so what we're allowing, and this is where the confusion gets in about training, is what we are allowing in the Tahoe TMDL is we're allowing, say, a Caltrans to build a large project that reduces a whole lot of pollutants, maybe beyond what Caltrans needs to reduce, and the city or the county could purchase those, essentially, or, you know, contribute to the project so that there could be one project with a number of pollutant load reductions, and they could be assigned to different entities, to the private sector, to the, you know, the city, to the to Caltrans. So there's a confusion around that, but it's similar but different, and it's because we're already at the ceiling. So it does apply here in some of these parts of the Mojave, but because we're looking in the Mojave at the ability to allow some additional growth or additional inputs at the same time, we're trying to achieve reductions, and I think there's a lot of opportunities, and I think that the one good example that is in place in the Mojave right now is the fact that you issued a permit to PG&E a year ago for the agricultural treatment requirements that requires PG&E to come up with a salt reduction plan, essentially, because we know salts are going to increase because of ag treatment. And so what they're doing now, and they have in the works, is asking dairy farmers to farm their land and to turn off their irrigation systems, essentially. And they're going to let fields go fallow so that PG&E can remediate chromium. And the great news about that is they're also removing nitrate because they're extracting shallow groundwater and they're removing tons and tons of nitrate. At the same time, they're increasing salts, but they have put some other fields to bed, and that will have an overall, we're hopefully an overall net, you know, no impact. And so that's why PG&E is at the table. They have they're already under a requirement from you to do this. And Logan and other dischargers may be able to learn from that. And we can. And I think there's a lot of great opportunity to help individuals that have high nitrate or high salty water, individual well owners, by saying, it wouldn't be better if we reduce salt nutrient loading at these locations where people live and potentially allow a little more degradation in some other parts of the basin where there isn't currently anybody using that water.
Any other questions?
I had a question about why is it that NWA can't hold back stormwater flows? What is it in the adjudication that prevents you from doing that? Why?
Well, if you think about it as a kind of surface water right kind of thing, everybody downstream is dependent upon natural flows upstream. So let's use Barstow, for example. Their aquifer, the floodplain out in their region, really goes down over a number of years and then pumps back up. It's almost like looking at an EKG. You know, you get long periods of drought, storm cycle. Periods of drought, storm cycle. And the concern for all the downgradient parties was that if people were to capture either desert wash-ins or, let's say, dam Mojave River, which sounds, you know, wild, but it's been talked about over and over and over and over again, that people downgrading would be affected, and that's actually true. So they would be getting less water in an area that has been classically, previously, for the most part, overdrafted. So any storm projects that are being built, that's one of the things that comes right up at the beginning of the project, that they can build a storm flow project to shave off peak flows, houses and stuff that get washed away, and they might have a big pond or a dammed up area, but it's not gated. And so it holds it back, and then the pipe at the bottom slowly drains that down back to the Mojave River, and it just keeps trucking down where it's supposed to go.
You can control the timing, but not the amount.
We can control the timing and the surge, but we can't control the volume, because the volume up gradient robs people down gradient, and so that is one of the underpinnings of the adjudication. So any material stormwater project that we have planned doesn't incorporate holding water back, therefore what always has naturally occurred is supposed to expect to continue to occur, and that's captured in the model because that's what's happened in the past and that's what we know and that's what we continue to do because we have to. Does that make sense?
Perfect.
Okay.
Lance, in one of your slides you projected growth in TDS and nitrate in the Apple Valley with new aquifer.
Yes, sir.
Under three different scenarios.
Right.
And scenario number three, growth with recycled water, showed a positive impact on water quality as opposed to growth with no recycled water.
Right.
Is that because using recycled water required less imported state of project water?
There's that. It's pretty complicated. Remember that free body diagram, all those ins and outs. So if you use recycled water, that's less water you have to pump. A lot of basins, when you pump the basin, older water from the peripheries of the basin that are more mineralized, is older, tend to move in. Because if you pump water, it creates a hole fills in, usually mobilizes older water from adjacent buckets. So there's that. Also the fact that recycled water is under your policy to be at a certain TDS. So whether you control the source water, where Apple Valley gets their water, they pump by the river, where we're recharging with high quality, low TDS water. Or remember, Apple Valley probably don't recall in your mind's eye, but out in Apple Valley there's like a little dry lake, a playa there, and if they have some growth inside the single well there, they're going to pull up a big red zone slug of high TDS water that's going to go to the regional treatment plant that has to adhere to their TDS limits that you folks have set. So they're going to have to add either more treatment, or we're going to have to be clever about it and say, we're not going to pump the red zone in this basin, we're going to pump adjacent to the river where we actually can do recharge, that active management, and that's where we discharge a lot of our state project water. We're going to maintain that high quality floodplain aquifer, make sure we get, you know, high quality sources of TDS, low TDS, either natural or imported, and then use that in Apple Valley. So does that make sense? Let me put a map up. Yeah, so it's there's lots of inputs and outputs. Also the recycled water, if you use it effectively, there's a lot of conservation, using purple pipe water, so it takes the water, it treats it, it puts it on lawns and whatnot, and then that salt's kind of locked up in the bayou zone, so that's part of it too, is less return flow. Reduction of septics. So there's all these effects occur, and it's very hard to pick one of those arrows on that free body diagram because they're all so interrelated. If you do one, it has a domino effect all through. But all those things that I just mentioned are part of this process. Each one of those 20 bases have individual arrows that do different things. So it's fairly complex. It's understood, but there's a lot of ins and outs. And the more we learn about our basin, the more complex they are.
One more question.
Yeah.
You mentioned that there was some subsurface inflow from LA County.
Right.
Does that, you think that means that there might be some hydraulic activity with the Antelope Valley?
Well, and this is this clearly there's the Antelope Valley adjudication, and we've been working with the folks on to the west of us about this common boundary. Our LA County line crosses a watershed and groundwater basin boundary. It's totally a geopolitical boundary. You know, that there's no fault, there's no rock outcrop that divides LA County and San Bernardino County. So there's interplay between those two basins. And we understand that basically it's just a bunch of coalescing fans with washes that come off the mountain at San Gabriel's. And there's really, and the reason we have a break here is because that's where the county drew the line a couple hundred years ago. So, or 150, what have you. So we have to manage that. We have to make sure that we don't pump and take all the water from LA. And vice versa, we were adjudicated, so that's all right. You guys are becoming adjudicated. We want to make sure that LA doesn't pump and pull all the water left and right. You know, so we're going back and forth. There is interplay on that boundary. It's complicated. There are areas where we believe, and I know that it's a kind of a legal case, so I have to be careful about where water's going and volumes and that kind of thing. But we believe that water is moving into the basin from LA, and there are parts of that boundary because it's fairly long. That water is moving out due to pumping that's up right along the boundary. This air farms going up to actually pull the gradient down out of the West Bay Basin towards Los Angeles. The parts of it actually move in as well. So the question is do we think it's going back and forth? Yeah. Do we need to manage it? Absolutely. We have to understand it first before we can manage it. And we've actually been working with the folks at Antelope Valley Education, AVAC, and LA Water Works on some cooperative programs. And just because there is a geopolitical boundary and that doesn't make a good management zone, we're actually working with the United States Geological Survey, taking some of the work they've done on their Antelope model with their gravity work to figure out what the bedrock looks like, to see what the natural breaks or saddles that separate those two groundwater basins. We're actually currently working with the USGS to do additional gravity work along the boundary that work collaboratively with folks up from AVAC to try to maybe figure out a better place to draw. We can't redraw boundaries, because that's a big deal, but we can redraw management zones that we can monitor and understand and agree to, and make sure that we're going to keep the basin right. So that's currently going on right now, and I think USGS is wrapping up their study.
I talked to Monday, and they just got the whole
game
back, so probably this summer.
Okay, so you'll have a report. I'll look at the graph and tell what the bedrock looks like along our common boundary, hopefully by fall.
Okay, thank you. And there's been a lot of chat about subsidence in the Central Valley. Is that a concern at all in the area?
It was. Subsidence generally happens in finer sediments, clays and silts, not gravels and sands. So in some of our areas around Playas, Lucerne Dry Lake, which is actually in Colorado side, El Mirage Dry Lake, for example, Harper Dry Lake, have experienced subsidence. It generally corresponded with the large amounts of agricultural production, usually in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, has slowed down, actually stopped. We have a study that we cooperated with the United States Geological Survey back in the early 2000s. They used INSAR data and they shot our lake beds, and they found that we had a couple meters of subsidence here and there. Over time, most of it occurred historically. That has generally stopped. But we still pay the USGS to reach numbers every 5 years to make sure nothing picks up again. So we have had some sites. It hasn't been huge, but it has happened. And we're keeping an eye on it about every 5 years. But it looks like it's pretty much petered out because ag's slowed down.
So there's less mining of water.
Less mining of water in those zones by the playas, which are more prone for the sediments to collapse. If the gravel is going to get locked up, but the clay is kind of, the pore space collapses on itself, and it's generally around your dry lakes and playas where a lot of agriculture is flat. They go there because it's flat, right? It's the lake. So they'll pump the periphery, and the lake will drop. We'll subside.
Thank you. Okay.
Any other questions for Lynn? Is it Amy who's still one of the last?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Uh-oh.
I have another question for all
of you. Another question is for you right now, but Mike, I do have a few questions for you. You made a comment about recycled waters coming online as we move forward, there is that potential. How would staff use this model that's been created to save some time so we don't reinvent the wheel on data. Will this, once it's adopted, will this become your data that you will use, or is there some additional vetting or analyses that you'll have to do?
Yes, we would use the data. I think we'll use the results for a new project. There's two things, actually, we'll be looking at, and the data can support both things. One is we're looking at anti-degradation analyses. You know, those things that we typically look at with a waste discharge permit, like a wastewater treatment plant, it's going to have a change in DES or nitrates due to whether it's a treatment through percolation or discharge to the Mojave River. You're looking at those kinds of changes. Well, has an anti-degradation analysis been looked at? What is the change? Is the change acceptable? Is it, do we still have to attain some capacity? Is it the best interest of people in the state to allow that degradation? Those kinds of things. But when you have all those data, those data are available to that project proponent to demonstrate that, hey, this is good to go. If it hasn't been evaluated, and then I think Lance's evaluation of all current projects right now, and you'll see if you get a chance to review the report, they've listed those sources right out there. Who's potentially a recycled water provider or producer. And so those things are in the report. And, the things that come down in the future, we should be able to plug those data and make those analyses fairly simply, what we expect.
Would new model runs have to be done on a project-by-project basis, or can you use the data from the
existing? I would think that probably a new model run would have to be done for introducing the data or a new scenario.
Probably depends on scale.
Yeah.
You know, the model is complex, and you don't want to, and you have people who run Stella for a living, so we have to, because they do it right, they understand the model, and so we don't have to ask for educated consumers, but we have models who do this all day long, and so we have to make sure we retain those and make sure it's done right so that there's no errors. So I think it's a matter of scaling the data, and the results are very solid, and could be used for smaller projects, and for a larger project, it might be worth that it's so complex or so large, or might have such a material change, that might have more initial model run and expenditure to that, for that effect. Not a whole run, the whole model, but hey, what does this look like? So that we'll probably cross that bridge when we come to it. But I think it's a matter of scale of how it's going to use the results, or just more in a model run. Probably a matter of scale.
Right, that was the second thing I was going to bring up is the scale. And depending on that project that's being proposed, and you would expect that when it's coming to us, we're seeing there's some analysis that's come with that project proposal. And you're going to do, you're going to prioritize how complex of an evaluation do you really need. Because if it's a very small or minor type of discharge, that complexity level will be much lower. So those have to be decided when we get that application.
Now, one of the slides that was put up, it shows a level of TDS recommended, SMCL is 500, and then the TDS upper limit, SMCL of 1,000, and really in most areas we're over the 500 already with our native groundwater supply. It's a real serious problem in our region. Have those SMCLs been set for the area? Do we do it on a project-by-project basis, or how will you use the upper limit of 1,000 and the recommended of 500?
All right. Yes, the limits are set. With respect to a single capacity, we're trying to stay, if the baseline is below one of those bars, we're going to stay below that. That's our goal, is to try to stay below that bar. Unless, it's in the best interest of the state to allow that degradation. And there's where that complex type of evaluation has to occur. We went through that kind of thing with the city of Victorville with their Snapple discharge, and I think, don't recall if you were on board at the time, but we did look at the fact that the discharge was going to allow a degradation that was going to be over 500. But it was going to be very local, very local. So we're talking about within the confines of the facility's treatment plant now. So that was I think acceptable when you do that best people state analysis. When we get an application, we're also looking at, again, those kinds of data that come in with the application. And if it's a facility that we already have a permit on, we have an understanding of what is the water quality and generally locally there at that facility. These data that Lance presented are averages for the bucket. So it may look like the average for the bucket is at 600. In one part of the bucket, it may be below 500. And particularly, we know that buckets that have a lot of demands on them, and they've exceeded one of the first levels of 500 in the new grant, that's when we've got to start thinking about, do we need more, better treatment for the best practical treatment controls to reduce those loads? Those kinds of questions have to be answered. Who else needs the assembly capacity? And in the future, requirements for that beneficial use of that assembly capacity and the benefit of it.
So when you look at slide number 14, and it shows the TDS for various areas, almost every area is already over the 500 TDS limit. It's just a real challenge.
And again, those are the averages for the buckets. You find in some of those buckets we have water quality that's well below 500. And in many of those areas, we know those data are actually doing pretty good in some of the cases. So
on the idea of the kind of cap and trade for water quality, I find that very intriguing. How probable do you think it's going to be for our region?
You want me to predict it? I'm encouraged by that, by the opportunity. And I think we have the right players involved, and certainly we'll expand our network or our stakeholder group to include more people, more organizations with some other ideas and some capabilities. I think we have a good group that's strong right now, and we have with the first step that we've already taken with the basic study that we want to get funded through your recommendation, we'll be able to tell you more definitively how probable will happen. I'm optimistic. It's probably the best way to say it. I'm optimistic. I think there are opportunities there. I would really like to see us be able to apply this type of concept with the dairies and try to reduce, they're struggling right now. And there's some loads that are coming out of those dairies. If we can get best management practices at a fraction of the cost a wastewater treatment plant to reduce a similar amount of nitrogen or TDS, let's look at that. Let's see if we can do that. And then can still have those dairies still be viable as businesses. And that's good governance.
So this may have some repeatability throughout the state then, where we're able to kind of refine parameters for how we can be using the groundwater.
I hope so.
Application.
Yeah, we're kind of cutting edge right now with respect to groundwater.
Any other questions for Mike? Okay, then I do have one speaker's card. It may help you answer some more of your questions, Dr. Horn. I have a speaker's request from Logan Bowles from the University.
Good morning, Brickers. $1 in past design by the group that are assembled in the Southern Mohawk region, because we've actually really done some remarkable things. Director Pumphrey, your question blazes self-interest. Awesome. Blazing self-interest. I'd like to provide a little context. Since all of us are analytically, technically minded, what we have a tendency to do is to start focusing on the branches and the leaves. And I'd like to describe the dirt and the trunks. If you all will recall, it was in 2012, and I believe it was 2012, when our NPDES permit was up for renewal. And if you remember that time period, you might remember a rather passionate discussion that I had with the board at that time. And essentially what occurred was that a new permit limit, which would reduce the nitrate in our discharge by only 0.9 milligrams per liter, had some very significant ramifications for my agency. And other states and across the nation, and even more locally now in California, there's been a rather consistent trend wherein your body has continued to focus on point dischargers. And as it should be, the Clean Water Act, I don't discount that. The real difficulty, though, is that when we begin to look at the return on investment of that focus, we have essentially reached a point where you are burdening agencies that are point dischargers with levels of regulation that require levels of treatment that are not economically sustainable. So traditional regulatory methods are becoming passé. What I believe we need to do is to find a new method by which we can continue to achieve the same regulatory goals moving into the future, but we can do so on a more holistic level. As Mike mentioned, this has occurred in many other venues. It's always been done for surface waters. When I looked at the impact to my own agency, that 0.9 milligrams per liter resulted in an immediate equity loss of over $20 million. It also resulted in us requiring to spend roughly about $15 to $18 million just to meet the existing permit requirement that would have been implied by that permit. And that would have been just to maintain service to the existing users. To address the building moratorium, probably an additional $10 to $15 million on top of that. So from a business case perspective, that 0.9 milligrams per liter, again, it was, I understand the roles each of our industries plays, wherein we are trying to discharge, we are trying to regulate, but the point was is we have to focus on the business side. So knowing this is when started looking at all of the great reports that have been done. So think of the fantastic work that Mahami Water Agency has done, Integrated Regional Water Management Plan that first came out. Also, our agency with the team of impact analysis and Mahami River characterization study. There's a number of documents that were there, but we were not bringing them together. So waiting for the Salt Nutrient Management Plan to develop to a point where we could begin to deduce some elements of what are we looking at in the future. Once it became clear that we actually started creating this cohesive view of our watershed into the future, to me it seemed a natural point at which to convene a group wherein we could start looking at alternative methods of regulating our area. It's exciting. My good partners that are involved, and I have spoken to my own board about this concept. We do have a few issues associated with our jurisdictional boundaries as well that we need to be looked at. However, my board is also in support of this. As it relates to the question about hope, is there a possibility? It's already been done in other states. They have addressed issues that are extremely difficult. Think about cross-state boundaries in the Chesapeake. We have a number of multi-jurisdictional, multi-county issues here in California that all are based on groundwater. So when you think about what's going on in San Joaquin Valley with selenium, with nitrate, those types of issues, it's my belief that we can actually create something here in our own region which could be replicated through other regional boards throughout the state, and then hopefully that at some point adopted by the state.
I know everyone's restless and wants a break. I want a break, but I have to ask some curiosity and some questions. I mean, most of these questions are for women. So hopefully it will be busy for you. Is there a hydrological connection between the Mojave and the Morongo?
No.
So the water flows back?
One way or the other, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's hard to say absolutes, but really, yeah, you know, I hate talking absolutes, but no.
Okay. So I used Stella for my dissertation, so I'm very familiar with both the great things that Stella models can do and also the limitations. And having built this wonderful model, I'm wondering that since Mojave Water Agency is relatively wealthy compared to some of our other urbanists in the region, can your Stella model be used as a shell that could help the other urbanists get a leg up on their salt?
You know, we started over 15 years ago with the monofill model, and so it's all predicated on a very complex, very expensive monofill model that was put together by the United States Geological Survey back in the late 90s and got wrapped up in the early 2000, 2001. So I guess in theory, but I'm not seeing how that would fit, because we started so far back. You have to understand your groundwater basin first, otherwise you can't model nothing, or wishes, or hopes. You know, you have to actually get the hard hopes, get the hard data, understand the geology to some degree, the hydraulic relationships, and then that's where the cell model was really useful to us, because it was based on real things, because a lot of those things, we just roll up your sleeves and do a bunch of work, years before.
So, Dr. has been the address at our climate change conference, workshop, last fall. One of my big aha takeaways, surprise lessons, was that the sort of cycle at which the groundwater in the Mojave Basin recharges on a 20-year storm is a big storm that recharges the groundwater for the environment. Mostly happens up in the headwater and not throughout the basin. So that led to a bunch of questions. So do dispersion rates vary over time depending on how close you are to one of those 20-year events?
Yeah, in the model we use, the model of the base curve from 1931 to 1999, hydrologic cycle, we repeated that. And you can see all those climate change and things like that. We've looked at it. We have to look at that as part of our integrated planning process. We worked with the Bureau of Information, who did some work on the San Ana watershed, and then moved it over on the dry side of the mountain, which is us, and continued that work. And, the conclusion is we get a lot of flashy water. It happens all at once, which is nothing new to the desert. Up in Northern California, it's a bigger deal. Less snow, more rain, goes all the way out the ocean. You couldn't catch it because of the snow melt that melts throughout the season. For us, we're kind of used to it. You get it, and then you get it all at one time. So that's captured in this model or this effect. The model does account for, does have kind of relationships built in, because it's built upon the output of a calibrated model that has a 60-year plus base period that has dry, wet, long cycles. And absolutely, when you get a slug of water through the Mojave River, it's almost like an arterial pulse that goes boom, and you can see it in all of the wells, you can see it in the water table, you can see it in the water contours if you do that work. And you see this arterial pulse that's on, really for us, we see this big pulse about 35 to 7. But, 20 years you get a big pulse or multiple that you're stacked. But, 2005 was a big year for us. 2010 was a big year for us. We're hoping 2016 is a big year for us. We're about to do, 98 was big. So you kind of see this staccato about 5 to 7 year, boom, arterial pulse, boom. And that fills up the floodplain aquifer, which raises all the heads, and then that drifts out, that artery drifts out the tissues, the joint, which is the reason why. So, big slug of water, high head, gravity's always working, goes out to the regional, you gotta wait 5 years, 7 years, boom, big flood, the floodplain, the big sand channel fills up, leaks out to the regional aquifer. So it happens very, very slowly. Those are the native pressures. You can overrun those by pumping a lot of water. Leaves can't keep up those arterial pulses or those storm cycles. So if you have concentrated pumping and you're in a tight aquifer system, that those pulses are subtle and they only occur every few years, you'll overtake that. Anything natural, you'll just overgrab that particular part of the basin. So there's that to contend with as well. And there's also where return flows coming back in. So it's a complicated system. I think the major factors are you can pump a lot in any particular part of the basin by choice and really change the natural dynamics of how that basin operates. And naturally, we're pretty well reliant, at least along the Mojave River, of those big pulses of water that happen about every 5 to 7 years. Or just, I know the 20 years were big pulses, but I'm thinking 98, 2005, 2010,
you know,
and so forth.
Well, I'm just wondering, maybe this is a question for Mike, is that then is that a factor to be taken into consideration on permits to discharges of a facility that's having a big impact on TDS or nitrates in some area, if those differences in
that's a good question. How do we incorporate pulses into the permit?
Yeah.
Well, first off, you permits are really looking at what is the current water quality now in the vicinity of that discharge.
Yeah.
And how is that discharge affecting that? That anti-degradation analysis and that hydrogeologic look at the water quality when we're evaluating a permit change should incorporate those kinds of things. Is it programmatically injected into that process? No. I think professionally and intuitively, one would be looking at that, evaluating how does the system that we're going to discharge into, how does it behave? And that's where all these data that they collected really come in to help us be more educated and more informed in how we look at the effect of this structure on the system.
Thanks. Yeah, I know it's expensive. That's a blue sky question, so a couple more questions for the moment. Are there parts of the model where you would like to see funds targeted to improve the model?
Well, I was not actually prepared for that. You're asking me, do we want resources or money? I should have been prepared for this. get GeoTracker Digital. That's one. Now, if we can get a few weeks of the life back, that'd be great. Hang out in front of the Xerox machine. It's hard to sustain. You know, we can update the model, or at least update our database when the Title 22 data, it's representative of what everybody's bringing, because you're forced to sample that because you're providing drinking water. I mean, and so the parts of your basin that you need to pay attention to are the ones that are being stressed. The ones that are being stressed are usually being used. The ones that are being used, folks are either temporary mandate, you have to sample them through science, or at least sample them and pay attention to the results, but no one's looking at the big data again. But because those data are digital, we can sweep all that, once you set up a robust data system, to actually look at all of the data. And I'll tell you, through this process, I'm just going to be frank, the GeoTracker stuff was hard to get in because some of it's digital, and a lot of it is in 3-ring binders, chrome binders on your shelves, and that is really, really tough. And some of it, you don't have local in the office because you can't have, you've got lots and lots of binders. So it's a lot of Xeroxing and tinking, and, human error. Potentially, it just makes the process a lot harder for us. That was actually a very material amount of staff time and attention to detail, which probably could have gone a lot faster and a lot easier if it's a digital system, digital age. So.
I'll just ask you if you want to come to this and someone else feel free. In terms of the water quality trade, so I'm very intrigued with this concept, interested to see how it unfolds. Have you thought about would the water quality trading be confined to the same sub-basin, or maybe if you have a lower quality, if the impact is make sense for a cheaper treatment up basin because the entire quality water coming down crazy. Have you thought about
a scepter or crown and just sit and say, yes, that's a question for me.
The goal, again, when they evaluate the feasibility of whether water treatment would work, those are some of the things that we have to look at. The goal is to have it occur in the same subbase, or at least hydrologically connected, hydraulically connected, I should say. That's a goal. Certainly, if you're in a subbasin upgrade that's going to have an impact which would be positive downgraded, then it would make sense.
It is fascinating, and I just want to share an example of something that we struggled with. I think the water board has a lot of authority, and there's a lot of policy that you guys can weigh in on here about, you know, our values, because a few years ago, you guys issued a permit for Mollycore when they opened up the mine, and they have a domestic wastewater treatment facility for their workers at the mine. And they have nitrate contamination at the mine site from natural conditions, as well as mining, as well as sewage. And we were looking at requiring them to treat wastewater that they were going to perk on top of this messy, nasty, you know, contaminated groundwater that no one's ever going to drink. And we thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if that money could be used to help some poor community deal with nitrate where people are actually using the water. And so that's outside of this groundwater basin, but it's just down the road on I-15. And I think the board has the ability to look at a very narrow watershed, you know, along the river, for instance, or broaden that out. I think some of that hasn't been tested legally. I talked to the lawyers, but it's an exciting concept.
Right. Okay, one last question. I promise the last one. Mine is pretty good. So I know that your recommendation is that for out of this is that there's no change in the water quality objectives, but the Santa Ana region developed sub-basin level water quality objectives. And looking at this data, it seems to me, I guess this is a question for the whole board to think about, but you can respond since you take it. Particularly with the sub-basins where we're below 500 TDS, maybe it makes sense to kind of put a harder ceiling there in terms of the water quality objectives for that sub-basin. I know that that's opening a Pandora's box for a lot of work, but so what are your thoughts about that? It seems to me that this is something that we might want to consider.
It is sub-basin dependent, something that they're struggling with this, the state board and the anti-variation policy and revising them, because they know that there are sub-basins where a similar capacity has already been exceeded. So what would you do in those cases? Employ enforcement actions and stop the discharges, or do you let them continue to discharge and then you have to have some mechanism to continue on there? They're struggling with that in state board members. So for us, where there's a sub-basin that the water quality, let's just say we're at 500 degrees, we've got to look at the future beneficial uses, future demands on a similar capacity. Those all need to be in there. Does it make sense to put a ceiling on? Maybe there will be future growth in that sub-basin where that ceiling might not be appropriate in 10 years. Or it might not even be feasible just because of overdraft or other things that are affecting water quality over time, not just the discharges that we regulate. So, yeah, you have to really, to go back to Santa Ana, look at what they did in Santa Ana. They had a lot of work and evaluation for their basins and a lot of resources applied to that to come up with those water quality objectives. That's a significant amount of effort. Not to say that effort is something we need to shy away from, but just to answer your question, it's kind of hard to do that without knowing all the context.
Yeah.
Does it make sense? Do we have an industry that's going to need that some capacity works? And does it make sense to go to 1,000? Or maybe just 700 in some areas. It's hard to really hard to just pin that down.
It seems to me that right now when we say, you know, we have these two different levels for TDS, using TDS as an example, and it applies across the whole high water agency area, that we then default to other decision making. The decisions that get made by other agencies, other groups of people, and we're kind of in a pretty passive position, as opposed to if we said in this area, you know, keeping higher water quality is really important to us, then we're weighing in and affecting decisions of the other agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's something to think about. So
that's why our participation in the urban. Our participation in Berwick's throughout the region is so important. Because now you're able to have those kinds of conversations with the water management professionals and stakeholders. There are so many other things that have to be considered. You know, we're thinking about maintaining beneficial uses and certainly those water quality objectives, but what are the other demands on that resource by other entities? And other agencies and people of California.
So I have had, can we put this on a workshop to elaborate on this whole question down the road at some point?
We can. I'm in the right place. I'm trying to work with this coming in the board. Wait on the fall meeting. Look, the board looks at through all the things we do on the policy area. Using one letter, so the range stretch of funding ideas. The next one, trying to work views, which is he's writing up his watch and writing up here. In the fall, that's going to come back to you to look at the longer list of ideas, and that's where that even is a discussion is that where we want to place our priorities in the board.
Thank you.
I better answer that question. Okay, the one about what you want. And actually, I think to make this work relevant, I'd like to work. It'd be nice to get an idea. I'm not going to say a commitment, but an idea, a curiosity about working closely together to maintain this work. Do additional runs as needed, as necessary, but maybe to use it towards the things like lamps and subject policies, and really use this and acknowledge this as a foundational data set that we all get familiar with, and at least acknowledge and use together. A collaborative process to make sense about for each of our respective regions, that was rolling out our cities, our planning departments, and so forth, just working together. I just like, at the end of this, I would like it to be relevant and not just be, hey, this is really cool, love pretty maps, and it's on a shelf. Let's use it. That's what I want. Thank you.
Well, this conversation about the water quality training is so intriguing. I look forward to seeing what you bring forward in the future. Yes, Mr. Cass.
Thank you. I'm Giles Cass, the regulatory unit chief in Bitcoin. You just indulge me. I have a technical question, but it has a policy and potentially legal implication. And I think it fits in with the question that Dr. Horn had, and that's in regard to our waste discharge requirements. Currently, we have one surface water discharge permit for Victor Valley where they discharge to the river, but all of the other state, all of the other permits we have for discharge are state waste discharge requirements. And fundamentally, the nature of the way we get data back in our monitoring program is unchanged for the past 30 years. We'll get a technical report that'll have data tables, maybe maps, charts, and graphs, and it comes in a report, and as Lance mentioned, sits on our desk. More recently, we're getting PDFs, which is just a picture version of the same thing, but fundamentally, the way the data comes in is unchanged. So I'm wondering, as Lance said, Ms. Bussi has spent a lot of time in our office waiting for this, if it would be appropriate to consider whether we should develop a standard that would or could require dischargers to submit that data in a certain format, electronic format, especially in the Mojave Water Agency, that would be compatible would upload to their data system that we could do, and then if, you know, would the dischargers be willing to do that, and then would that format be Title 20, not Title 27, would that be GeoTracker format, and could we require a waste discharge program discharger to submit that data into GeoTracker? And so I think it's something that in the regulatory unit we could explore if there's a benefit, and it's not obviously a question that needs to be answered right now. But for that limited suite of dischargers in the Mojave Basin, there's probably a dozen or so. And of course, the data is very focused to where the discharge occurs, so it's not, it's just one element of the data that it was used in this model. But just thinking about that. Thank you.
Great idea, great question. I mean, if I could just add to that, it is a great idea, and I think for all of our databases, even for surface water, beyond groundwater, GeoTracker, our databases go on. I know the State Forest is trying to certainly put some money to modernize, if you will, some of those databases. I think there's a long way to go in that. But I think the goal is to have them more usable, which is right. It's not just this database, it's all the databases, but a tad clunky. So it would make all of our lives easier and for discovery and recreation in a useful way. So I'm hoping good ideas like Jay's and others in our offices, we can start pushing them up through the state board as they get funding finally to update these databases that would be part of.
Well, as we conclude the discussion on item number 9, are there any last thoughts the board members would like to share on this topic? Seeing none, let's take a 5-minute break.